Hello and welcome to episode 5 of Rain City Bunker. I'm your host, Andy Brown, and I'm here with Greg Moon.
Hello.
And we're going to keep the intro to the show pretty short because we've got an interview coming up. It's with a Dr. Jeanette Heyer, and she's a geneticist at the University of California in San Francisco. And she's an old friend of mine from college. She's going to talk about a variety of things, and it's fun, and it's kind of an organic interview. There's a couple times she yells at her kids and Greg's phone rings and stuff, but I think that actually kind of adds to the humor of the whole thing. And I'm just going to let Greg talk about a couple of housekeeping things, and then we're going to go right into the interview. So, Greg, take it away.
Yeah, we have a couple follow-ups. The Montauk Monster, there's a follow-up on that. And the Urban Phantom, the black bear that was loose in Seattle, there was a happy ending to that. We'll put those links on the website. And also, Andy and I have been hearing about and experiencing trouble with streaming our podcast. And I jumped on that last night when Andy said someone had told him about it. And I figured we were using the Google player. I'm going to use the Yahoo player, and that seems to work on IE just fine. And also, I'm going to put an instruction or two for downloading. We've had people ask us about downloading. So if you have Firefox, which I use, you just click the button, the download button, it automatically downloads. But if you have IE, you need to right-click, and I will put a little quick instruction under each download button to make sure everyone who wants to can download and listen to Rain City Bunker. And what follows is a fun, interesting interview with Dr. Jeanette Heyer.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Rain City Bunker, our interview with Dr. Jeanette Heyer, who is a geneticist at the University of California in San Francisco. How are you doing, Jeanette?
Hi, how are you?
Good. And I'm going to call her Jeanette instead of doctor, unless you have a problem with that.
Please don't call me doctor. It's so silly. Call me Jeanette.
Okay. And
I only made my family call me doctor.
Okay. And it's not to diminish her accomplishments, but I've known Jeanette for a long time. We met back in college back in 19 rah, rah, rah. So it'd be weird for me. It feels weird to call
her
a doctor.
But I just met Dr. Heyer, so maybe I should just call her Dr. Heyer.
No.
Yeah, but nobody calls me Dr. Heyer.
So okay, Jeanette it is.
So specifically, what's your focus in genetics? Because I know a lot of times, like, lay people kind of misunderstand sometimes that it's like there's like a focus in genetics that you have, correct?
Yeah, and the focus is trying to understand how different genes are interacting to form for development, to how you get from no eye, like for example, how you form during developing. I guess the genetic or the human disease thing would be like birth defects birth defects.
Okay, okay. And that's studying the eye and the genetics and the development of the eye. You've been doing that for – is that what you got your PhD? Was that your the focus that you had in your PhD? Was it the eye development?
Yeah, it was.
Okay.
When you knew me at Stores and I was like all the time doing something – I was working on Drosophila, fruit flies.
Right, right.
And so that was more of a kind of a hardcore just figuring out really how genes interact, but that's just a model system, and I moved to a different model system to do more complex organs, how they form.
Right.
So I don't have the right kind of eyes.
Go ahead.
They have eyes.
Now to get first things first, Jeanette, we're just kind of wondering, you know, where did your interest in this field begin, and what's your educational background?
I guess, you know what, I think I really liked biology in high school. Like I remember my mom loves to tell this story where I was a junior in high school and I was pretty adamant that I wasn't going to go to college because I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I had a guidance, you know, do you remember you had to take those tests that told you what you like to do?
Oh, good. What color is your roof? Yes.
Test. I think I said I should be a farmer, you know, this kind of stuff. Everyone
yeah.
should be a farmer. So I couldn't figure out what I wanted to do, and the guidance counselor thought I should go into the Army. And then I had a high school, like my 12th grade biology class was really great. And so then I decided I would like to do that. And so then I kind of just really focused on that right from starting at university.
Do you mind if I take an aside? Because I've forgotten about those, like those aptitude tests. And I think, I swear, I think mine said I should be like a plumber or something like that, a plumber or like a forest ranger?
I think you did miss your true calling as a plumber.
Yeah.
You know how rich you'd be if you were a plumber?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, not to diminish like plumbing, not to do that, but I remember just like, how the hell did it come up with that? I have no interest in anything like that. But,
you like how things go together? Do you like to solve puzzles like that? Do you like water? Water!
Oh, man.
So what college did you go to, Jeanette, your undergrad?
For undergrad, I went to UConn Storrs. And that was fine. And then after that, I went and I worked for a little bit in the lab just to make sure.
What's your undergraduate degree when you're out of school?
Yeah, right when I was out of school. I went straight to New York City because at Storrs at that time had like literally cows. Like you could hear the cows from my
Storrs at that time had
nothing. Right?
What? Say that again. I'm sorry.
Storrs at that time had nothing.
Had nothing, and Storrs, just to clarify for people that don't know, that's the little town that the University of Connecticut, the main campus, is in, and it's pretty much Storrs is just UConn. That's why people use UConn. It synonymously.
There was nothing.
There was
there.
Nothing there. No.
And you got your
clothes on the weekends, and you couldn't eat anything. It was crazy.
And you got your degree in biology there.
I got my degree in biology there, and then I went to New York City. I teched in a lab for a little while, for about a year, and I realized that basically a technician in a lab means it's just being an organic robot. You just do the same thing every day. So pretty quickly after that, I just decided I needed to get my advanced degree. So then I went to grad school, and I stayed in New York. I went to Cornell.
Cornell. And then it's, I feel so ignorant about this. Then it's from grad school, then you apply to PhD programs, right?
Is that no, the grad school would be it was a combined. In sciences, it's usually combined master's PhD.
Okay, gotcha.
And then you usually pop out of there and you do a postdoc, which is an advanced apprenticeship.
Okay.
Which is sometimes a career, sometimes a deal breaker. Like something you get there. Yeah, there's just some. Sometimes people lose it there because you get some real individuals to work with that are nightmares. But they had a really nice guy. Then we came out. Then we transferred out here, and I got a kind of a junior position out here to do my own stuff. So then that's why I'm here.
Now, getting a PhD program, like I have a friend who's an ethnomusicologist, and like I said, I have earlier to you when we were off the air, I have a friend who's an anthropology major. And there's kind of, you have to do like a paper or a project. What did you have to do? Did you have to present like a research, for lack of a better, it kind of sounds like I'm diminishing it, but did you have to do like a research paper or a project or something like that to get, that had to be okayed by a panel to say like, okay, you've
Yeah,
you've
I mean, in the
PhD.
Largest sense for all of these, a PhD would be whatever your subject, you have to go out and you have to figure out something new. Either like if you're a literature, you go and you read a bunch of, I don't know, of Jane Austen's work and you come up with a new idea of what she was talking about, something like that, right?
Right.
But in science, you basically read a bunch of people's work, you decide what experiment that needs to be done to answer some fundamental question that isn't known, and then you spend 5 years, you know, doing these experiments to try to come to some kind of conclusion. And in the most pure way, it shouldn't matter whether you get a positive answer. What should matter is whether you designed everything correctly and you looked at all the possibilities and outcomes and you came to a conclusion.
Right.
And there shouldn't be gaps in like something that you should something you should have looked at and you didn't. And so the committee basically just makes sure that you followed every possible thread to figure out what was going on, and then you came to a reasonable conclusion. That's in the perfect world.
Right.
In the real world, you know, you probably need to publish something, and you need to spend like usually 6 years. 6 years, I think, is the going number of years, and then they finally decide that something that was good at 4 years. Something that 4 years was not acceptable, at 6 years all of a sudden is acceptable.
Gotcha. It's like you kind of have to put in your time.
So just to clarify, so you didn't get a separate master's. You went right from your undergraduate to your PhD program?
Well, kind of a combined master's.
Kind of a combined.
In the sciences, they kind of combine that.
Okay.
They combine so that the master's is all your classwork, and then the PhD is, in addition, 3 more years of just working basically at doing the research.
Okay, so technically you do have a master's and a PhD.
Yeah.
Okay, great, great. So I'm always interested because I never went to grad school. I was interested how that all works. And how, and what was the length of time you spent getting your master's and PhD there?
I spent 6 years.
Six full years with all the research and getting it finalized and everything?
Yeah, and that's not, it wasn't, yeah, that's kind of the norm. I mean, I had switched advisors because the first guy I started working with turned out to be a holy, just a freak. And so a lot of people have to switch. It's like, you know, you work very closely in with people. And
please don't name him so we don't have any legal
problems. No. And then it just takes about 6 years,
wow.
I think.
Did you get tired of school, or were you ready to jump into doing your own thing, or besides the personalities involved?
In each of these cases, it's so individual. I had a really good mentor who let me pretty much do what I want to. And we got along very well, and he didn't have an ego or any kind of my way or no way, my way or the highway mentality. And so my situation was really great, and I could have stayed in that situation for many, many more years. I was having a great time.
Okay, so, was it very challenging? I imagine it was, but did you at certain points just kind of pull your hair out, all the work that was required, or is that more undergraduate?
The thing is that when I look back now, because, like, for example, yesterday I was pulling my hair out. And so when I look backwards, I'm like, oh, those were idyllic times. Whoa. that was so great. But, of course, at the time, I kind of have the feeling that the theory that we all have a level of stress that we always try to maximally achieve. So if I'm not stressing over that, I'm stressing over some other kind of nonsense. So
I don't think Greg knows this, but the other thing was is that you were pregnant with your daughter while you were going through the PhD program, right?
Yeah, I had my first kid when I was getting my PhD, yeah.
Before you got the PhD?
Yeah, before I got it, and then I had my second kid right after I got it.
See, I always imagine, this is kind of funny, I always imagine like you in a lab, in like this lab coat, and you're like knocking over test tubes.
Yeah, that's pretty much what it was. I was very clumsy dropping things, because I got really clumsy.
And you get everybody else to like pick it up, you're like, I can't.
Oh, no, the funny thing actually, when I was first pregnant, I have never really used much radioactivity in my studies,
right.
But when I was pregnant with my first kid, I decided I needed to do this experiment using radioactive phosphate.
Does she glow now?
Oh, is there her two heads? She's so smart with those heads. Whoa.
So, and I have one question going back to undergrad. I remember when you were studying I'm going to mispronounce it, but the Drosophila flies?
The fruit flies? Drosophila, yeah. Fruit flies, yeah.
That I seem to, and if I've gotten any of this wrong, please correct me. But you were studying generations of these flies because it had been noted that a protein showed up whenever there was a mutation.
Yeah.
Okay, and that you had a theory that it wasn't just like a waste product or a byproduct of the mutation. It was had some sort of catalytic properties in the mutation. What was the result of that? I don't think I ever asked you about that.
Well, I don't even know whatever happened with that, with all of those many hours I spent crossing those flies. But the idea was that you had, like, one mutation, and it was supposed to change the eye color. So these are all models, because who really cares about the eye color of flies?
Right.
But if you mutated this gene, you would change the eye color from white to red or from red to white. And the studies I was doing were showing that you could do this, but you can change the eye color of only half the eye, and it was a very organized boundary. So it would be either the front or the back or the top or the bottom of the eye. And so we were going around trying to figure out why you would get that kind of funny pattern.
Right.
You would think that you change one gene, and so we were looking for it was some kind of overlay of some secret overlay information. See, one of my kids just showed up. She found into the tree. God damn it.
Oh, sorry. We're rated R. We've won.
Oh, you are rated R.
My phone's going off.
Greg's got a phone call, so.
We'll ignore that.
So he was kind of just looking for over patterns for what you see.
He's going to run off. So I guess this is an appropriate time now to talk about, like, Jeanette is, you're like hiding under a tree from your family so you can talk on the phone with us, right? Is that?
It's crazy. Can you imagine?
So did you manage to elude your child?
Yeah. See, now that she is okay. I managed to elude her for 20 minutes, which is an excellent amount of time.
That's a new record.
It's a new record. And then you might think that, oh, these are, you know, this is these are toddlers and it's really hard. But no, this is a 10-year-old girl. And you see, they just follow me around and pester me with things.
Just tell her you're on a major broadcast and that you can't be disturbed.
Oh,
will she buy
okay.
that? Have you done interviews before, Jeanette, by the way?
No, I usually don't do interviews.
Oh, okay. Well,
kind of hermetic like that.
This may be the start of something wonderful.
So now you're at the University of California, and you're in the neurosurgery department, right, of University of California? In San Francisco. And so explain a little bit how you, with your developmental genetics experience and so forth, how that blends into the neurosurgery department.
Well, if you just took it, like the way I explain to people who don't people that I don't want to divulge my whole life story to, like, for example, at one sitting.
Right.
I just I tell them that actually the eyes during early development, the neural system forms a tube, just a neural tube. This is very early in development.
Right.
And the top of it are the, where the eye, all right, you know, I need you to go because I need to talk. I just can't be distracted, okay? The top of it is two little bulges form out, and that's going to be the future eye tissue. And that forms so early. It's specified and it's organized before you can see anything that looks even really like a brain. It just is a tube. And so the question is, you know, this is part of neurobiology, and then in the neurosurgery, it's kind of an awkward title. I work in a hospital situation, so all of the departments are mostly clinical departments.
Gotcha.
And a lot of the neurosurgery focus at UCSF is on brain tumors. And there are some developmental brain tumors, like one is called medulloblastoma, which is a tumor of the lower part of the hindbrain.
Right.
A childhood tumor. Another is called retinoblastoma, a tumor of the eye. And another is called neuroblastoma. These are all kind of, you should think of them like kind of embryonic cells that were never received the directions to differentiate and to, you know, make their final form. And they're kind of hanging around as embryonic tissue, which really is all about dividing.
Right.
So in that way, I kind of touched down of fitting in that department. I also have close ties with the ophthalmology department,
right,
where I work a little bit in eye formation and kind of the understanding of how the eye is pieced together and formed as a final organ. It's really, really complicated because many different pieces are pulled in to make this final form.
Right.
And so you can, for human disease, you can talk about eye defects, but you can also talk about glaucoma because glaucoma is a pressure kind of regulation in the eye, all regulated by a funny little tissue right near the lens.
Right.
And so you can talk about how that forms and how to regulate it. So that's that would be on my that's my webpage description or something.
Oh yeah, well, if you don't mind, we'd love to put your link up at our website for your web page.
And it's okay if you don't want us to either.
Okay,
if you
don't want us to, that's
maybe.
Fine.
I don't know.
All right, we'll talk about that.
Well,
the world can already see it.
Picture.
So you gotta
take a picture. Make sure the picture is good.
Well, you work on that. Let us know, and then I mean, it's already on the internet, so the whole world could find you if they wanted to.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
So we would just help the world find you, the 20 listeners we have.
So one of the things we wanted to talk about, and we're going to do it while skillfully avoiding the political aspects of it, but Greg and I are, I think I've told you, we're kind of on opposite sides of the fence politically, and one thing that's kind of come up is the idea of, like, government funding science.
Mm-hmm.
And as Greg and I kind of argued our various points, we both realized that we didn't quite understand how it functions.
Yeah, we don't know if we're arguing over 1% or 90%. Yeah. So, and that affects the argument, right? If you're arguing of a big chunk of a percentage of the basic research, maybe that has more bearing than percentage.
So could you explain a little bit, like, the role of government funding in your with your job, basically, and with your research?
Okay. So when you say 90, how much, when you were saying 90% or 10%, how much, you mean how much does the government fund?
I think that's one aspect of it, yeah. Oh, you're breaking up a little bit, sorry.
Let me get closer to a computer.
A little bit.
Okay.
There, that's
better.
That's better.
Okay. Okay. I would say that NIA or government funding is indispensable, and there's a couple of different ways that you can get government funding. And it's indispensable because even though you have lots of philanthropic private funding streams, like for example. Mostly for disease interest groups who are fundraising to promote research on your specific disease. And there's, of course, the well-known ones and the not-so-well-known ones. But the really the only thing that covers salaries, say, is the government funding. So you can have, like, for example, I have government funding through the National Institutes of Health, which does all the kind of funding that you can ever tag a disease to. And the other kind of funding is the National Science Foundation, also government. And that does things that are not so much disease-related, like a lot of the physics, astronomy, stuff.
More basic physical sciences.
Yeah, more like or like marine sciences, stuff that you can't say, here's a human disease, mm-hmm. and this is what this would be applicable for. And then the third is the Department of Defense, which just sounds like crazy stuff. Like, what? You got some Department of Defense funding? I'm really interested in that.
So the Navy SEALs could have webbed feet, for example.
No, don't laugh. You never know.
Gills and stuff.
So government funding is the way it is now, at least in the U.S. And I think in most countries, government funding is essential because even these small groups, they... It's worse now than it used to be, but they were always kind of very much ones that know exactly what you were doing. They don't like to fund salaries of, say, directors. They like to fund salaries of maybe of a technician or some technical support and supplies. They like to fund because they know that if you're in a university setting, you have other obligations. You have obligations to teach or to be on committees or to do a lot of university stuff. And so they don't want to be paying you to do that.
Right, so they're very specific and targeted with the private money.
Yeah. And then company money is UCSF is well intercalated in all of the Bay Area biotech companies. And they're great. That works out great, and you can really use that to help you. Only if, for example, you are doing things that they're interested in.
Right.
And sometimes sometimes that works out really great, but sometimes it doesn't. Like sometimes they're not interested right now in that thing. And I'm not even saying. For instance, I know Genentech used to be really, really interested in this one protein called nerve growth factor that was supposed to, it was thought maybe would regenerate nerves. You could just add it and it would regenerate nerves. It doesn't do that, but that, yes, it was interesting and there was some promise, but lots of work in university-driven laboratories and at Genentech showed that was not going to be that simple. That was not going to be the most simplistic thing.
Right,
ever.
They didn't see that. Well, that brings up an interesting question about how much ownership do these private companies and industries have over discoveries that you make? Like, what is like the patent process? Or, I mean, without getting too detailed, like there has to be some sort of expectation of return on
their
money.
Like, they at least get a license or
yeah.
whatever it may be.
It's let's see, it's kind of, there's two kind of companies, say, or there's two kind of weird patent things. One is for example, the universities didn't used to be so smart about this, but they've gotten a little smarter, and there was a kind of an uproar not too long ago when universities were just making patents on genes. Like, I patented the gene for this.
Right.
Like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
Or making patents on huge portions of the human genome.
Right.
Which is, the human genome has all been patented. And you just can't quite wrap your mind around what that possibly means.
Yeah, that's very interesting to me, because can you patent something that already exists? I mean, the human genome exists.
That's the question.
Discovering it is a different question.
Well,
I discover the chemical formula of, a long time ago, diamonds, you don't own all diamonds.
Right.
You know what the formula is. I mean,
well, that's the interesting thing, Greg. I don't know how much Michael Crichton have you ever read, Jeanette?
Some, a book or two, yeah.
And it kind of, he died just fairly recently.
Oh, recently,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, and but a kind of running theme in some of his books, like, for example, Jurassic Park, his most famous one, and then, like, the last book that he wrote, which was called, ironically, Next, is this idea that private industry getting involved in science and how that kind of runs contradictory to one of the principal philosophies in science, which is really publishing and sharing your information and technology so others can build on that. What are your feelings on that? Do you think that's a kind of a tension in involving private industry in science? Or it sounds like they're working to repair that. It sounds like you said that there was a problem with universities doing that, and now they're kind of moving away from that a little bit.
I think that they, I don't think they're moving away from it at all. I just don't think that they figured out what it will end up happening with it. I know that there are situations where, in order to get around this, not in a written, it has to be this way, but in kind of a, how do you say it, when companies do the right thing so that no one comes and says, we need legislation,
Right.
But usually there, sometimes there's
With
two
like
prices.
good practices or whatever.
Yeah. Sometimes there's two prices, one for the quote-unquote non-profit organizations and then one for profit organizations, so that you pay less for using this thing because you're going to be using it not for... So this is like a lot of stuff that's patented is not necessarily drugs. And drug discovery, I think, is... I don't know much about it. I don't know a lot of chemistry researchers, but that might be where I think that you would see real danger,
right?
Because you've patented away the chemical backbone, and then I know what happens in pharmaceutical companies is that the lawyers get on the chemical backbone of this thing, and then they write a patent for every possible permutation of that chemical,
right?
And so that's why no one can touch it. After that, no one can touch it. But in terms of a lot of stuff that's patented by companies would be these kind of reagent companies that not necessarily don't have a direct link to curing or to become a drug. But say, for example, the guy who won the Nobel Prize last won it for cloning and making a kind of a use of this thing called green fluorescent protein, which is a protein that you could just put in a cell, and you've heard of this because you have like the green dog or whatever.
Right, the glowing animals, basically.
Glowing animals, right.
That's South Korea.
And
isn't it?
So basically, he cloned that and published that. He has also made many variants of that and cloned a red protein and a yellow protein, et cetera, et cetera. And it's funny because you can buy that from a company. It's
right.
A very famous and huge biotech production company, but it'll cost you like a ton of money, or you could just ask the guy to give it to you, and he'll just give it to you.
Well, now that breaks up because a lot of people have heard of the glowing animals, and beyond the very awesome possibility of having like a glowing Labrador retriever or something like that, there is a real specific use for attaching this. I'm going to say this wrong, but attaching this glowing gene, it doesn't allow you to kind of use it as a marker to study other genes or help me with this, Jeanette.
It allows you to, so you can attach it to other gene products. So you attach it to proteins,
right.
And then it allows you to follow in a cell, for example, where that protein is going.
Right. So that's one of the, and that will bring us to probably our next topic. But it's when you read about it in the news, when you hear about it, I think people see that and they go, you know,
it seems trivial.
It seems trivial.
It seems like they're just doing it to prove they can do it.
Yeah, and you go like, why the hell is this guy getting a Nobel Prize for making like a, you know, a kitten glow? And I've always thought that's one of the problems with science reporting or how science shows up popularly is it doesn't really get into depth explain to people why this is important. So, and I know you have some connection. I want to say your husband had some connection several years ago to that news story that was really hot about how like scientists may have found the fat gene, right? Am I remembering that wrong?
Yeah, he didn't, not directly. He worked at that same university.
Oh, okay.
That was the one they sold for $10 million.
Uh-huh. Well, can we?
Yeah, funny, huh?
Yeah, so so as you explained it to me, which didn't come out in the news so much, is that it was a gene in a certain kind of mouse that seemed to be connected to fat production, correct? Is that?
Yeah.
So basically what the news media, so basically like real scientists published this, you know, their research, then kind of, you know, there's those people that work, you know, as science reporters for magazines and newspapers and TV, and then they kind of scour publications and then they see this and they go, oh, this is going to make a great story because, you know, so many Americans are fat, you know, and then it becomes like scientists have discovered the miracle, you know, gene that you could turn on or off to, you know, do away with the 20 pounds you gained by eating McDonald's, you know,
right,
for the last several months. But that's not really true.
It's just a basic discovery at this point.
Right.
Yeah, and they've gone a little bit farther. Basically, the evidence for that it being involved in obesity was they made a knockout mouse that was missing it, and the mice were, or they, they somehow messed with the genetics of it in a mouse, and that mouse was obese.
Okay.
And so that was all the proof that at the time, I think it probably wouldn't happen again.
Right.
Well, first of all, once bitten, twice shy. That was the kind of like the proof that this gene might have been involved. So the company went and they patented that gene, and it ended up being a receptor, and it's involved in the use by the body of fatty acid chains, and the sense it's kind of like a pseudo hormone receptor, and so it's involved in sensing the content of fat in the blood, but fat is used for many things like constructing cell walls. So it ends up being involved in a lot of development stuff. And it's not just, you know, it's not just involved in the kind of fat that when people say fat, what they mean is how much are you absorbing and how much energy are you storing in your fat cells.
Right.
It's not involved in that at all. It's involved in the brain. And it's involved in many, many functions, including mood and every kind of thing in the brain, because it's just a hormone receiver. And, you know, can you imagine, like, for example, the ones we know best, testosterone and estrogen, have a lot of different functions. Like, they change everything. Like, if you take testosterone out of a male system, you change, like, many things.
Yeah.
You don't just change one thing. You change, like, everything.
So that makes me kind of wonder, like, I think one of the popular misconceptions about genetics in particular is people liken it to like computer programming, where it's kind of binary. It's like you turn this on and then turn this off. But it's actually much more, how do I explain it? Like, it's kind of more like a spider web or like a net, right? Because things are connected to other things. Like, if you were to mess with this one gene, that might cause effects that you're not expecting because it has other functions, or am I kind of off on that?
No, it's true like that. So it is a spider web, but a spider web, I think, still gives a little bit the implication of binary. It's much worse than that.
Yeah.
For example, you have genes, of course, code for proteins, and proteins are the things that get the stuff done. And the proteins, like, for example, you have 10 genes, and they code for 10 proteins, but that protein all assembles into one complex that does a job.
Right.
Say, uncoils a particular portion of your chromosomes for the transcription of these 10 things. So this would be a second order thing. So the genes, those 10 genes, the original 10 genes that code for the components of this one huge complex, you can disrupt any of those and the complex will fall apart. And not even an all or nothing complex. For example, you can have a half mutation, so you have half as much as you should. And so now you make half as much complex, and that gives you a different readout, because it's not really, you know, it's all thresholding, actually. Right. It's not binary. It's hardly any of it is binary.
Right, right.
And so you have overlapping thresholds, so that, say, if you have the expression of 10, say, of the three genes, in order to get this outcome, you need gene A at 0.5, gene B at 0.7, and gene C at 0.1 to get this outcome, to get outcome 1. And if you change those thresholds, you get outcome 2. And if you change them again, you get outcome 3.
Yeah, so it's like an analog.
I'm sorry, Jeanette. Kind of an analog system where you tweak one thing and the other things change as well. And there's a complicated interrelationship among all these different genes and the proteins they produce.
Yeah.
That's actually,
and binary, we really got the feeling of binary stuff from the fruit fly,
right.
but the fruit fly, it's truly astounding that many of the genes that are in a stupid fruit fly, you know, next time it's buzzing around your strawberries, you're like, whoa, it's just crazy. Many of the genes are the same.
Wow.
You can find a fruit fly gene for, it's very, here, just for the eye example. You might have even have heard this because it's always used, this example that's used over and over again. But a fruit fly gene for, it's called ILIF or PAC6. So you knock that out in a fly and you don't get an eye. And so, and it's very clear. It's one gene. If you have it, you have an eye. If you don't have it, you don't have an eye. If you overexpress it in this other kind of part of the fruit fly that is a little bit tweakable, you get an eye there.
Ooh.
So, and everyone's like, oh, that's so cool. And it is. It's completely cool. But the difference is that when you move to a vertebrate system, like humans and even mouse, there are 6 reiterations of that gene, slightly different. And you knock it out. You don't knock it an eye, but you get many, many different things going on. So it's not, that's where you lose the binary thing that we always thought from the flies, you'd see very clearly, yes, no.
Right.
But in more complicated systems, you don't see that.
So it's partly a function of the complexity of the creature, the living organism that you're studying. A fly is more binary, but as you move up the chain, there's a lot more levers to switch for an eye. Instead of just one for a fly, there's 6 as you go up to vertebrae.
Yeah, exactly.
So one of the other things I wanted to talk about is, and I know you said you felt like you kind of weren't prepared, and don't worry, I'll help you with this. But, like, is there anything, like, kind of popularly or, like, literally, like, a movie that you saw or TV or something where you're just like, ugh, that's so wrong? Or maybe even it surprised you and they got details right? Can you think of anything?
I don't know. I let's see. What was the one? What's the one where where Will Smith is playing the end of the world guy and he's in New York and
I am Legend.
I Am Legend.
Yeah, I love kind of things where the cities are just completely trashed.
Yeah.
And also I went through the whole summer watching dystopia movies. That's right. The one where the Children of Man.
Yes, I love that movie.
Oh, that's great. So things like. That, like, the Will Smith is, like, finding the cure, the vaccine, and every kind of thing. I mean, those are the only recent ones I can think of. But
just a bit, sorry.
Let me get closer to the one I keep coming back to, I guess the one that lodged itself in my mind was, I'm only thinking of popular stuff in terms of biology.
Right.
But you know the movie Gattaca?
Yes.
It's ages old now. That one really, really made me kind of think about what it would mean to really use, or what is the outcome of all of our knowledge,
right.
Let's say.
Well, let me, just for the people who don't know what Gattaca was, it was, when did it come out, like 96, 97, something like that?
Yeah, it was ages ago.
Yeah, and it's Ethan Hawke and Uma Thurman. In fact, I think that's where they met and got married. But it's basically about a future, not too far in the future, where genetic engineering has really taken off, so people kind of custom designed their children. And there's the main character, his parents decided to not do any genetic tweaking with him, and he's kind of disguised himself and integrated into the society. And his dream is to go into space, right?
Yeah.
And yeah. That's an excellent movie for kind of talking about the problems or issues with this sort of thing. Don't you think?
Yeah, because and the reason that it sticks in my mind and is because it used to be that we all thought we could maybe cure cancer, and it's not as easy as it's going to be, mostly because it's again not going to be a quick thing to figure out. It's going to be much more complicated, and cancer is just like kind of the end product of 100 different things that could go wrong, and kind of they do,
yeah.
You know, and the path is not straight. So I think we have all of this power of technology that we developed for that kind of stuff, and power of imaging. You should see how well you can, the images that come out of an MRI machine are now.
Now,
really, you can see everything. And since we're not going to be able to immediately cure anything with that, what is going to come of it? And you know what's coming of it is that you can clone your pet. I mean, Christ Almighty, right? You can clone your pet, and you can get full body scans for no reason except that you think you should have one every year.
Right.
And you can. Get your genome cloned if you had the money for that.
Right.
Like, you could do that. And, what's going to happen with that information? Like, what is that? What's that going to be?
I've always kind of thought is, you know, people are always like, what if the wealthy, which is a danger, you know, like, what if the wealthy begin to, like Gattaca, begin trying to ensure that the genes in their children guarantee things like intelligence and height and what we consider aesthetically attractive and so forth. And my thinking is I certainly wouldn't want to be the first generation of people trying that, because, you know, like, for example, how many really intelligent people have you known that are just not right in some way? They're almost, you know, it's that kind of like genius as
Bill Gates would be the example. I think we talked about last podcast.
Gates. But, you know, and then there's that question. I think it's all anecdotal, but like a lot of the people in Silicon Valley have children who are autistic. And people sometimes kind of wonder, is it if you get, you know, so all these people who are science minded move to Silicon Valley, and it's and perhaps that created, you know, those genes also cause an expression of autism. So I don't think I'd want to be one of the first people to tweak my kids genetically. Maybe after some other people had done it.
Well, but you can exactly see how that will be headed. I mean, people have been trying to tweak their kids with, you know, educational resources forever.
Yeah.
And this would be the next logical kind of step.
Well, I think Greg had a question.
Yeah, Jeanette, I was kind of wondering, we talked about this our last podcast, and the concern I have, and I know it's not really your field, but close, genetic engineering. And like, for example, when they engineer crops to produce better or naturally resist pests. And from my experience, I'm a software writer. I write software. And I see how complex just a simple software program can be. You can get unexpected behaviors in just like 1,000 lines of software code. So if we're introducing these modifications into the environment, do you think that perhaps there might be unexpected interrelationships and unexpected consequences? Or conversely, are you just totally confident that stuff we do is very safe and no problem at all? Big question for you.
You could either reassure us or scare the hell out of us right now.
Yay for science! Science is always right! You know, the tricky thing is that really the companies like to frame genetic engineering as used to be animal husbandry, and we've been doing it for years, which is true. It's true, and you can use genetic engineering to hasten that kind of animal husbandry idea, where you just simply try to select for the best possible traits that you want in your crop of corn. Like, you want it to be like this. And that's, you know, that seems kind of fine and normal. And I think and that's still going on, the genetic engineering to kind of get more of the advantageous genes of that species in a single plant, say. And I'm not so sure, for example, I know soybeans and corn are the big GMO kind of crops. And when the kind of thing that gives me a little bit of pause, and I'm not even sure that I have any basis for it, but the kind of thing where you engineer plants to express stuff that plants don't express, and that would be the whole Monsanto corn crop that expresses a resistance gene so that you can spray the whole field with something really nasty and the corn still survives. And I don't think that it's well understood what it's expressing is going to be doing for a plant or any kind of thing. But on the other hand, then, you do overexpress this protein so that the plant can survive a massive spray. And the plant is a normal plant. It reproduces. It looks normal. It doesn't really change the ability of a plant to function. And the thing is that when humans ingest that plant, do they develop, I would say, some kind of reaction to that foreign protein, which is kind of like a kind of thing like if you ingest any kind of crazy plant or you ingest an egg and you have a crazy reaction to eggs. And I guess the thing I is missing is more study about human reactions to these kind of
right.
foreign proteins, because if you look down your labels, do you know how much stuff soybeans is in?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Everything.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Are you saying so things that are kind of like naturally selected by humans during the ages of farming, you're more comfortable with those sort of things, like a bigger kernel of grain or, a cow that produces more milk? You're a little less comfortable with kind of like foreign introductions of like a gene that, a new protein in the plant that resists like a massive chemical attack.
Yeah.
Well, I think what you were talking about, Jeanette, is like a plant that's really resistant to pesticides, so they can kill off every pesticides and herbicides, so they can kill off everything that they don't want, and it has the crop that they want. Right? Is that what you were talking about?
That's one example. Another example is kind of trying to juice the plant with more. More of these plant growth hormones in the same way that they kind of juice cows.
Yeah.
And it just ends up being, what is going to be basically the immune reaction or the immune response of humans to that. And I think of it more, in terms of, is this going to provoke immune responses to humans and only in humans? And that ends up, you might think, you get some allergies, but it's the problem is the widespread nature of these crops, and that immune reactions can be quite serious.
Oh yeah.
So, that's really quite serious. Not even if you don't have anaphylactic shock, but you're just now sensitized, and now you get autoimmune reactions. Insulin is an autoimmune disease. Alzheimer's is thought to be an autoimmune disease. Like, just kind of like, you have no idea. You just don't know.
Right. So it is a complicated system. I mean, all this biology, since you research the genes, you know how complicated it is.
It's super complicated, yeah.
So there can be unexpected interreactions between some of these things.
Yeah.
Well, now that...
But I think the world is, maybe, I don't know. I live in the Bay Area, so it's really hard to tell what the rest of the world is. so, hippy-dippy here. But, It might seem like perhaps in the whole movement maybe to be more organic, and the failed experiment that a lot of farm areas and developing countries are finding with having to be wedded to these genetically engineered crops and the pesticides and the special pesticides that you need to treat them and all this kind of stuff, and the monoculture problem where, because, of course, every seed company is going to protect its crop, its special genetically modified crop, by making it infertile.
Well, you constantly have
to buy seeds.
Yeah, that's kind of spooky if you put your... planting all these acres of food that can't.
What do they call it? They call them like suicide crops, right? Because after a certain, and that's always disturbed me too, because like the whole monoculture thing, because diversity is a great protection against disease. And let's say if you're this company that's kind of forcing all these farmers to use your crops and they're all the same and there's some sort of
suicide thing.
Well, not only that, but let's say there's some sort of disease that or fungus or something that attacks these crops and they're all the same, that could wipe out a whole that could wipe out a whole crop, food crop or something like that, which I think is very dangerous.
No, it's happening right now with this kind of wheat rust. I forget where I read this, but there's a funny old guy who worked on a wheat rust, which is a kind of a parasitic infection of the wheat, and it's in Africa, and it's happening kind of right now, where a lot of the crop is just being completely overrun by this pest that they had kind of found resistant strains to and then planted them all over the place. And so now it's a kind of a monoculture there, and now this is just coming back through again because, it changed a little bit. So I think that we'll genetically engineered soybeans and corn and these big crops are probably here to stay, and maybe I think we should consider ourselves lucky that so far nothing has happened. And I know in Europe, and probably maybe here, it'll be a combination of trying to legislate more and also attention being kind of like shifted to like, this isn't such a good idea in general.
Right. So I don't know. Did you get a chance to listen to our last podcast?
For some reason I couldn't download it.
Oh, brother. Okay.
You can blame me on that.
Yeah.
One.
Oh, okay. I mean, I could listen to it on the computer, but I was trying to download it and listen to it while I was doing this other thing, and I couldn't. I didn't listen.
Sometimes you have to right-click. Well, I'll put more instructions, more detailed instructions.
So we had a thing. There was a Wall Street Journal article about people. They called it biohacking.
Uh-huh.
And basically, it's just people of varying backgrounds doing their own kind of biological experiments in there, like some of them in the closets of their apartments and so forth.
Uh-huh.
Did you get a chance to see that article? I don't know.
No, I didn't even see that. And now I should have seen that.
Well, you're a busy mom and scientist, so we forgive you.
So just quickly, it brings up all the, like there's a guy in Seattle who's working with, he has a warehouse and he's working with algae trying to produce like a better biofuel. There's a woman in New York in her apartment who is experimenting around with E. coli to some, and she's like 23 years old and she's experimenting around with E. coli, some idea she has about cancer. I don't have the article right in front of me, but so just knowing that, I've just told you about that. Do you have any feelings on that? Do you think that's like, because one of the positives that we were talking about, the negatives are really obvious, like the real scary stuff is obvious, but one of the positives that like Greg and I were talking about is like when you look at the history of like the computer industry, a lot of that began in like garages and basements and so forth, and people found all these really amazing uses for that technology. And I'm just wondering, do you think that that's kind of a cool way to go with biology, or do you think that's just, does that just give you the willies?
No, I think that's a really cool way to go, and I don't think it's on the level of anything to be worried about. And the reason is because a lot of what we know about biology is very close and careful observation. You know, just observing like what is going on, and then the next day you do this whole thing and something's a little bit different. And that takes just time time to observe. And, you know, it's interesting to think about, but, you know, if you were in, say, the middle of a huge lab, maybe you don't have the time to do all of that observation that's necessary.
Right.
So I would imagine that something very cool will come out just from the very basic, simple observations of the simple process of observing and thinking about it.
Right.
And then the other thing is that a lot of, maybe less so in chemistry, but a lot of the stuff with biology is really expensive. It's super, super expensive. So I don't think that you will be able to make anything,
is part of that expense just the time required by scientists to observe and record and everything?
Are you asking, is that expensive?
Yeah,
I
imagine that's a big part of the expense.
Yeah, but also all the reagents, all of the specialized equipment that you need to keep stuff alive. Like, you know, sometimes a chemist can, I don't know, I don't feel like it's too scary.
Yeah,
that's,
I think, the scariest thing in biology perhaps would be maybe microbes and virus production.
Right.
Virology.
Right.
But, I don't know. I guess in the end you just have to trust people. I mean, I could go into my garage and I can go into the lab and I could probably make a pretty nasty virus, but I probably won't.
But you're not for hire.
But she absolutely will not do that
to any
NSA or CIA agents.
Like,
listening.
I could be a hacker if I wanted,
but I choose not
to be a hacker.
But you know, that's the first... Wow. I mean, because that's really interesting that you say that with your specialized knowledge. And if... just really quickly, when we were talking about this in our last podcast, I'm slowly reading it, but what's his name? I think Frank Herbert, the guy who wrote Dune. He wrote a book in 1983 called The White Plague, and people have been recommending it to me, and so I'm finally reading it. It's basically about this guy whose wife and children are killed by an IRA bomb, and... He's a geneticist, and hello?
Yeah, I'm here. I changed phones to make it. I think that phone was, the battery was going.
little crossover there. And he decides to kind of get revenge on the Irish and the British and the Libyans, because he feels they had an influence, by creating this pathogen that kills off women. And spreading it around.
And that's his revenge.
That's his revenge. And the really crazy thing, just kind of funny, I said this last time too, is in the book, he goes to a district in Seattle, and the guy describes it really well. But he kind of sets up a whole thing in his basement. It's a little chilling to hear you say, like, you're like, if I wanted to, I could kind of go make something really nasty.
Well, it's been about 50 minutes, Jeanette. We really appreciate your time.
Well, before you cut her off, I just want
one. I'm not cutting her off. I'm just
one last thing, because I wanted to talk about this. When I was talking to you about doing the interview, you were kind of involved in a whole. You were on a jury.
Oh yeah, I was on a jury. Yeah.
And I know when I was on jury. You know, I got called for jury duty, and one of the things I ultimately didn't get picked. But one of the things they talked about is they asked people if they watched CSI.
Uh-huh.
And I wonder, so you got selected for the jury, right?
Yeah.
And what kind, can you talk about it? I don't know if they...
I don't know. I guess if they don't mention names, I can, right?
Okay. What kind of case was it?
It was a police officer who was accused of theft.
Okay. Did they ask that question? Because the attorneys asked, you know, whether we watched CSI and so forth.
No, they didn't. They asked us if we watched Law and Order.
Because
it was a banking thing, so they asked us if we knew anything about banking.
Because I was kind of wondering if you're being a scientist, if they were like, oh, good, now we got somebody who kind of understands science and the limitations of it and stuff. Because that's how it was explained to us, is because the problem is now is everybody thinks, like, you know, there's always, like, absolute scientific proof for crime. But anyways, I just wanted to ask you if that came up in your... in your jury selection?
Not in that jury selection.
So is there anything else that... Yeah, I see Greg's got another call. He's extremely popular right now. So is there anything else that you wanted to... you wanted to ask about how we felt about, like, science education when we were growing up, right?
Well, only because I was thinking... I'm thinking about future careers, you know, second careering.
Yeah.
And I just wonder, why isn't everyone a biologist? Sometimes I'm like,
Well, you know...
What ruined you in high school so that you're not a scientist?
Well, I know in my case, I kind of look back, and it's something I still kind of combat. It's not that I didn't have an interest in science. I'm just so lazy, and I think it's a lot of I think it's a lot of work, you know. And I know, Greg, you're kind of a science geek.
Yeah,
you kind of
yeah.
Like science.
Well,
and
when I was in
engineering and stuff like that, though,
it's very detailed. It's very tedious. It's like accounting.
Yeah, but I also think, Jeanette, I read this book that I think you'd really like called American Nerd, and and.
Are you accusing her of something?
No,
Andy?
No, not at all.
Whoa.
No, but one of the things the guy brings up is like how culturally we think of intelligent people, and like right in the beginning of the book, he talks about Frankenstein, and the image of Frankenstein is this guy who eschews like all these other human aspects like love and feeling and emotion and everything, and just lives in the brain, and he does these things. You know, with science that he shouldn't be doing without even a thought of what he should be doing. And you know, that's this kind of popular conception of people who live intellectual lives. And I think, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine from India. He was saying like in his schools, the kids who were like who were really smart and everything, they were like the popular ones. Everybody wanted to be around them. And I'm thinking like outside of elementary school, and correct me if you think this is wrong, Greg, like your experience, like outside of elementary school, when you hit like junior high and high school, that's something the smart kids, the really smart kids like cover up that they're smart. And because it's almost kind of like something that gets you ostracized. I don't know. What do you think about the both of you?
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. But I have a middle school kid, right? And I think, she's in an environment, one of these hyper environments, where everyone is doing Saturday school, except for herself.
Oh my god, okay.
Yeah, it's like that. It's just a public school, but it's kind of like the public school or the classes in the public school that she's in. And I don't know, I hope there's been a kind of a change where the idea that you can be really smart and you can be into you know, the Jonas Brothers, and into like popular culture and stuff.
Twilight.
You can do that. You can do those two things, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Now, I've had this conversation a few times, which I think is very good, very interesting, is, you know, in the black community or some minority community, sometimes that's especially true, I think, Andy, that, you know, if you're smart, you're not really cool. But with President Obama, who's obviously very intelligent and very articulate, that may be affecting, it may be not just minority communities, but maybe all communities, like, hey, we have this hip, cool president who's very smart. Maybe that helps to get rid of, you know, and I've talked to different people about this, and that seems to be the consensus that kind of makes being bright or academically gifted more acceptable, more
mainstream.
Well,
I've also kind of wondered, too, that I know, like, a lot more girls are going into science. You do some teaching also, right, as part of your job, right, Jeanette?
A little teaching, yeah.
And what's the mix? Do you find, is it equal or more women than men, or?
I think, well, not in the maths and engineering yet, but in biology, there's more women than men.
Yeah, that's what I've
heard.
But
there's not more women higher up than men.
Oh,
it
okay,
falls
that's
out
okay.
pretty fast.
But I bet that will change. And but I kind of wondered if that's because I think it's probably a little bit easier these days, and I could be wrong on this, but a little bit easier these days for kids, for the girls to kind of pursue that sort of thing than it is for the boys. I wonder if there's kind of, like, once again, that kind of stigma of being a nerd, but I don't know.
I guess one last question. Since as a woman in science with a doctorate, do you ever feel any sort of that you don't fit in, or are you given just what you're feeling? Do you feel comfortable in that academic and research?
Yeah, I feel really comfortable, but I kind of decided, and I don't know if it's going to bite me on the ass later, but I kind of decided a while ago that, hold on, what? I'm on the phone! They keep finding me. I kind of decided long ago that I would just do my thing and just change it from within the culture. Like, so for example, you know, my poor kids are always, you know, let's see, how would you say? like, I'm just not going to be a dude but who wears a skirt, you know. So it's a fundamental difference, and you just have to not play by the rules that other people, like, for instance, in science it's said that if you don't make your discoveries by 35, you're washed up.
Right.
But for women, really, especially like if they have a family and stuff, they really peak at like 45.
Right.
Because now they finish all their responsibilities, whatever, and, you know, now they have more time, and so that's a fundamental difference. Yeah. And, you know, so we'll see if that ends up happening, that, you know, people aren't written off when they're, you know, if they're not superstars by 35.
Right. Excellent. Excellent. Hey, well, you know, it's, I think it's been about an hour, right?
Yeah.
You're
so interesting.
Jeanette,
you're so interesting.
And it was great. I think it came out really great. And actually, it's going to be hilarious, the yelling at your kids. That's awesome.
They're all right in front of me, staring at me like, what are you doing? How come you're not meeting our needs right this second?
So So do you think, like, if we come across any kind of science stories or whatever that maybe you could comment on, could you be our correspondent, our science correspondent?
Yeah, I'll be your correspondent from the field.
Or advisor.
Sure.
Our science advisor.
Science advisor. Well, once again, that's Dr. Jeanette Heyer, and thank you so much for being on our show. And I think you're... Oh, you know what? She's our first actual PhD that we've talked to.
All right.
Hopefully there'll be more. But once again, hey, thanks for being on the show.
Hey, a pleasure.
Well, that wraps up episode 5 of Rain City Bunker. I thought we had a good interview, and we hope to have some more. And if you have suggestions for a future show, or you think that there's somebody that we should interview or a subject that we should talk about, let us know. We're open to that. And we will see you next time. Thanks. Bye.